Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 186. It's Monday, November 7th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I just want to remind you that this is a news show. You may just hear stuff here earlier than you would otherwise hear it. This is true for COVID. An Omicron tide is coming in. And such tides, nature has a way of mooning us when we don't pay attention. One measurement of COVID is COVID in sewage. This is the best, most reliable predictor, early predictor of what is coming in the next few weeks. And it is rising in Ohio and Michigan faster than most any place else in the U.S. You may very well be seeing a recent rise in respiratory infections among those around you, but be prepared for COVID to join that rising tide as we get through fall and into winter. COVID hospitalizations in Ohio are already making their move upward. So, get your booster shot, get your flu shot, wear a mask in indoor public spaces. COVID is still killing thousands of Americans each week. We can each do our part to stave off the worst COVID has to give us, if not to you or me, to vulnerable people such as seniors and immunocompromised who would like to stay connected to us in life-giving ways, not deathly ways. And while COVID-19 is a formidable foe, it is a mindless foe. But I have to give it some props. Man, has it evolved. We've come a long way since the pandemic first started, and I want to do a couple stories here that just get to that. This from Medical Express. Keeping Omicron infection risk low requires 50 times more room ventilation. With SARS-CoV-2 variants continuing to evolve, building scientists and air quality specialists have assessed the ventilation rates of rooms required to keep the risk of infection under 1%. Concluding that Omicron and its sublineages require ventilation some 50 times greater than the virus did when humanity first encountered it in the spring of 2020. The Delta and Omicron variants require ventilation rates roughly 20 to 50 times greater. This is difficult to meet for actual building engineering. Wow. And along those lines, the next story from the CDC. Probable aerosol transmission of SARS-CoV-2 through floors and walls of quarantine hotel in late 2021 in Taiwan. Aerosol transmission through structural defects in floors and walls in this poorly ventilated hotel was the most likely route of virus transmission. This event demonstrates the high transmissibility of Omicron variants, even across rooms and floors, through structural defects. Our findings emphasize the importance of ventilation and integrity of building structure in quarantine facilities. So, yes, when you have poor ventilation particularly, it builds up. That's why indoor public spaces are particularly important to take additional protections, such as wearing a mask. And these reminders perhaps deserve a reprise from Corey the Coronavirus.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, You don't even have to touch me. I understand. Because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, some people have been eagerly awaiting to see if the new Omicron booster actually provides more protection. And it looks like there's some evidence that shows that might just be the case. This from the Washington Post. Pfizer says new booster shot increases Omicron-fighting antibodies. Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech announced last Friday that their updated coronavirus booster shot targeting the Omicron variant succeeded in strengthening the body's army of disease-fighting antibodies, even as questions persist about the vaccine's continued effectiveness against a swarm of later-generation versions of Omicron. The findings reinforce the public health message that the new bivalent boosters, which were rebooted in September to match newer Omicron subvariants, could help protect people this fall and winter. Based on all the data we now have in hand, we have confidence in the bivalent COVID-19 vaccines and their ability to create better protection against COVID-19, including these currently circulating variants, than the original vaccine would have, said Peter Marks, director of the Food and Drug Administration's Center for Biologics Evaluation Research. He urged the public to consider getting the updated booster ahead of Thanksgiving. And in the rest of the world, which as a whole has not done much better than the United States as a so-called advanced economy, with over 1 in 3 people worldwide that have not been vaccinated at all, this from MedPage Today. Expert panel releases global roadmap for ending the pandemic. Whole of society and whole of government actions must be taken to end the COVID-19 public health threat, according to a large multidisciplinary panel of experts from over 100 countries. In total, the group developed 41 consensus statements and 57 recommendations, broken down into 6 primary categories, including communication, health systems, vaccination, prevention, treatment and care, and pandemic inequities, noted Jeffrey Lazarus of the Barcelona Institute for Global Health in Spain and co-authors in Nature. Despite improvements in the global response to the pandemic, including extensive research and development of preventive measures and treatments, the public health efforts to end the pandemic have varied considerably for each country, due partially to misinformation, unequal distribution of vaccines and treatments, and inconsistent global coordination, they said. We're at a time when many people, including political leaders, believe the pandemic is over or coming to an end, Lazarus said. And yet variants of concern, persistent infections, still high mortality, and the lottery-like specter of long COVID demonstrate that we have not ended COVID-19 as a public health threat. We sincerely hope decision makers throughout the government, health systems, and industry will benefit from our work to end this threat. Most importantly, our top-ranked recommendations must be implemented. They are a whole-of-society and whole-of-government approach, along with a vaccines-plus approach, which means prevention measures that include and go beyond vaccination. We can do this, we should, and we must. The panel largely focused on trust in governments, the consequences of misinformation, and the dissemination of large volumes of new COVID-related information, noting that governments themselves may be a source of misinformation. To tackle these issues, the panel called for improved collaboration between community leaders, scientific experts, and public health officials to develop public health messages that build and enhance individual and community trust. They also urged more partnerships between public health officials and individuals or organizations which are trusted within their communities to facilitate accurate and accessible communication. One other approach to combat false information is to encourage public health officials to use clear, direct, culturally responsive messaging that is free of unnecessary scientific jargon. The panel also recommended that researchers and developers work together with social media companies to implement controls for their platforms that reduce publication and dissemination of false health information. In addition, the panelists called for more attention to be paid to disproportionate effects of COVID-19 on vulnerable populations, emphasizing the need for high-income countries to fund equitable access to vaccines and treatments for lower-income countries. Well, you know, folks, public health requires a lot of coordination, planning, and persistence. And still, some people see this as smacking as some kind of conspiracy. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, next up in more infectious disease news, this from Reuters. Considerable monkeypox transmission happens before symptoms, study suggests. Monkeypox can spread before symptoms appear, British researchers said last Wednesday, providing the first evidence indicating the virus can be transmitted this way. It was previously thought that monkeypox was almost entirely spread by people who were already sick, although pre-symptomatic transmission had not been ruled out, and some routine screening had picked up cases without symptoms. Monkeypox, a relatively mild viral illness that is endemic in several countries in Western and Central Africa, exploded around the world earlier this year, with outbreaks in dozens of countries where it had never previously appeared. There have been almost 78,000 confirmed cases and 36 deaths since, according to the CDC. Although cases have peaked in many countries, this week the World Health Organization said the outbreak still represented a global health emergency. The virus is known to spread through close contact and causes symptoms including fever, body aches, and often painful, pus-filled skin lesions. So this study is interesting. It's basically, this study found that actually the majority, over half of transmission actually happened asymptomatically. So very interesting finding. Okay, well, switching gears, next up from the Cincinnati Inquirer, abortions dropped 65% in Ohio following overturn of Roe v. Wade. Abortions in Ohio dropped by 65% in the months after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and the state imposed a six-week abortion ban. But the national picture was divided into states with restrictions on abortions and states without. By August, abortion was completely unavailable in 10 states, including Kentucky. Nearly 22,000 fewer abortions were performed in states such as Ohio, with limits on the procedure over the summer. Those numbers were partially offset by an increase of more than 11,000 abortions in other states. Ohio had one of the largest declines among states that retained any abortion access. Many Ohioans traveled to surrounding states to obtain abortions there. Illinois saw a 28% increase in abortions between April and August. Indiana had a 15% increase. Michigan saw an 8% increase. and Pennsylvania had a 6% increase, according to the report's estimates. In mid-September, Ohio's six-week abortion ban was placed on hold by a Hamilton County Common Pleas judge. That decision restored abortion access to in Ohio up to 20 weeks gestation, or 21 weeks and 6 days after the last period. Ohio Attorney General David Yost, a Republican, is appealing that decision, but the legal battle could take months. Both sides expect to end up before the Ohio Supreme Court in 2023. And in more abortion news, this from NBC News, travel time for abortions tripled and requests for pills soared, investigations into effects of Supreme Court ruling show. More than a dozen studies, reports, and editorials published last Tuesday in the Journal of the American Medical Association investigate the effects of that decision and highlight the many ways in which state-level changes are jeopardizing pregnant people's health. One of the newly published studies showed that it took people 100 minutes on average to travel to abortion facilities in September, compared to an average of 30 minutes before the Dobbs decision. The share of women of reproductive age who lived more than an hour away from an abortion facility rose from 15% to 33%. Another study found that unintended pregnancies, which are expected to rise, put mothers at increased risk of depression and interpersonal violence. Infants born as a result of an unintended pregnancy, meanwhile, face a higher risk of low birth weight and preterm birth. This is the new despicable normal, said Dr. Linda Brubaker, a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of California, San Diego, who wrote an editorial summary of JAMA's special issue. It's really going to lead to story after story of heartbreaking maternal and child loss. Yep. Just one of the many effects of criminalizing healthcare.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, I want to do a couple stories about alcohol-related deaths. First up, from the New York Times. Alcohol deaths claim lives of working-age Americans. An estimated 1 in 8 deaths of Americans aged 20 to 64 in the years 20 to 15 to 2019 was a result of injuries or illness caused by excessive alcohol use, according to a new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The study, published last Tuesday in the journal JAMA Network Open, assessed the effects of alcohol on people of working age, who accounted for nearly two-thirds of the country's annual average of 140,000 alcohol-related deaths. The rates of excessive alcohol use and related deaths have most likely climbed since the period the CDC researchers analyzed. After the onset of the pandemic, a variety of data showed Americans drank more frequently, and deaths due to a narrower set of causes attributed to alcohol rose 25% in 2020 over the previous year. Although alcohol takes a progressively heavier toll on older age groups, its effects are more noticeable in younger people who are less likely to die of other causes. Among those aged 20 to 49, 1 in 5 deaths was attributable to drinking. And for those aged 20 to 34, it was 1 in 4, the study found. If anything, the study underestimated the true number of deaths because the researchers did not include every cause of death in which alcohol played at least some role. There is ample opportunity to improve access to treatment services, experts say. Millions of Americans struggle with alcohol use disorders, but their medical providers do not typically counsel them to reduce excessive use or offer them medications that can blunt cravings. Evidence-based strategies are out there and underused. The CDC's Community Prevention Services Task Force recommends a number of measures, including raising alcohol taxes and regulating the number and concentration of businesses that sell alcohol. So there's an over concentration of alcohol selling businesses in low income and minority communities. And this is associated with increased alcohol use. So there's an equity issue there involved. Last year, Congress permanently reduced federal alcohol tax rates, and state alcohol taxes have generally not kept up with inflation. But in some hard-hit states, advocates are beginning to push back. In Oregon, there was a campaign to raise alcohol taxes, and lawmakers in New Mexico recently held hearings about doing so. And in a follow-up report that gets to the more recent changes, this from Medical Express, alcohol death toll is growing, U.S. government report says. The rate of deaths that can be directly attributed to alcohol rose nearly 30% in the U.S. during the first year of the COVID pandemic, according to new government data. Alcohol is often overlooked as a public health problem, said Marissa Esser, who leads the CDC's alcohol program, but it is a leading preventable cause of death. A report released last Friday focused on more than a dozen kinds of alcohol-induced deaths that were wholly blamed on drinking. Examples include alcohol-caused liver or pancreas failure, alcohol poisoning, withdrawal, and certain other diseases. There were more than 52,000 such deaths last year, up from 39,000 in 2019. The rate of such deaths has been increasing in the two decades before the pandemic by 7% or less each year. In 2020, they rose 26% to about 13 deaths per 100,000 Americans. That's the highest rate recorded in the last 40 years, said the study's lead author, Marion Spencer. Such deaths are 2.5 times more common in men than in women, but rose for both in 2020, the study found. The rate continued to be highest for people ages 55 to 64, but rose dramatically for certain other groups, including jumping 42% among women aged 35 to 44. Excessive drinking is associated with chronic dangers such as liver cancer, high blood pressure, stroke, and heart disease. Drinking by pregnant women can lead to miscarriage, stillbirth, or birth defects. And health officials say alcohol is a factor in as many as one-third of serious falls among the elderly. It's also a risk to others through drunken driving or alcohol-fueled violence. Surveys suggest that more than half the alcohol sold in the U.S. is consumed during binge drinking episodes. So, you know, we tend to see alcohol as, well, it's you know, largely, recreational use. But I'll say that again, surveys suggest that more than half the alcohol sold in the U.S. is consumed during binge drinking episodes. So, quote, alcoholic or abusive drinking actually accounts for the majority of alcohol consumption. Even before the pandemic, U.S. alcohol consumption was trending up, and Americans were drinking more than when Prohibition was enacted. But deaths may have increased since the COVID-19 pandemic began for several reasons, including people with alcohol-related illnesses that may have had more trouble getting medical care, Esser said. She added that the research points to a need to look at steps to reduce alcohol consumption, including increasing alcohol taxes and enacting measures that limit where people can buy beer, wine, and liquor. Yep, alcohol outlets in poor and minority communities is predatory.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callus always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Next up from Stat News. Millions of Americans have health insurance that isn't good enough. The open enrollment season for health insurance is gearing up at a time when more people in the United States have health insurance than ever before. Yet millions of Americans who enroll this fall still won't be able to easily afford the health care they need or will be hit with medical bills they can't pay. Why? Because whether you have health insurance through an employer, the individual market, or even through Medicare, High healthcare costs and coverage exclusions are making insurance less protective each year. To be sure, being insured is still much better than being uninsured, something that's been known for decades. The Affordable Care Act built on nearly 60 years of progress in expanding insurance coverage. Starting with the inception of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, successive incremental reforms have brought the U.S. to the point where there's now only 8.3% of Americans are uninsured. Although that is higher than any other industrialized country, it proves that political will and steady reforms, the American way, can bring us to a better, healthier place. Such a low rate of uninsured people is worth celebrating, yet it is also important to ask about the millions who are insured. How good is their health insurance? Unfortunately, the answer for too many Americans is not good enough. While the ACA created a limit on how much some people have to pay when they get sick, health plans frequently fail to keep people out of medical debt, provide timely access to health care they need, or ensure that people can afford the medications they need to stay healthy. In a recent survey conducted by the Commonwealth Fund, 40% of working-age adults who were insured for the full year said they had to skip or delay health care they needed because they could not pay for it. 37% struggled to pay medical bills over the past year or paying off medical debt over time. Among all respondents, 23% were underinsured, meaning their health care costs and deductibles were especially high compared to their incomes. And they suffered nearly as much as those who were uninsured. 60% reported delays in care due to cost, and 60% of those who did not get care reported problems paying their medical bills. In short, too many Americans are covered by health insurance with such huge cost barriers and exclusion that it's coverage in name only. And this is far from just a problem for people with private insurance. 20% of Medicare enrollees age 65 and older are also underinsured. The U.S. can do better. People paying premiums for health insurance should be guaranteed affordable care when they or their family members need it. As good a call as any for health care for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Next up, a follow-up to a story that I've reported on before, this from MedPage Today. Pulse oximeters need to work better for dark-skinned patients, FDA panel says. Pulse oximeters are less accurate in patients with darker skin, and the FDA should notify patients and providers about the issue and recommend that manufacturers correct the discrepancy, an FDA advisory panel said. In addition to pulse oximeters that are used in the hospital, a very large percentage of the population come into contact with those inexpensive, non-medical pulse oximeters that they buy from department stores and grocery stores and pharmacies, and they rely on those to decide whether or not they should present to the physician, said Murad Alam, professor of medical social science at Northwestern University in Chicago. You have to really think about those as well. Committee members agreed that even though the studies they reviewed looked only at in-hospital devices, the non-prescription devices were likely to also have the same issues. While the FDA is not required to act on the recommendations of its advisory committee, it usually does. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Next up from MedPage Today, U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, no hormone therapy to prevent chronic conditions after menopause. Steer clear of offering hormone therapy as primary prevention for chronic conditions, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force advised in an update to a 2017 recommendation. Also in line with the 2017 recommendations, the task force recommended against the use of estrogen alone for the primary prevention of chronic conditions in postmenopausal persons who have had a hysterectomy. The updated guideline is largely congruent with those from several other medical organizations, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the North American Menopause Society. Instead of hormone therapy, either oral or transdermal, the task force said to reference their other prior recommendations on how to prevent cardiovascular disease and other chronic conditions in adulthood. Regular screenings are a common prevention strategy, the group suggested, including screening for breast cancer, colorectal cancer, osteoporosis, high blood pressure, plus diabetes and type 2 diabetes. The updated recommendations only apply to asymptomatic postmenopausal individuals considering hormone therapy to prevent chronic conditions, and not for those who experience premature menopause due to primary ovarian insufficiency or surgically induced menopause. They also don't apply to women who are trying to manage menopause-related symptoms like hot flashes. No longer should patients use hormones to stave off the multidimensional consequences of natural menopause or aging, but neither should they be frightened away from considering using menopausal hormonal therapy for distressing symptoms that emerge in midlife or reflexively urged to use other pharmacologic therapies that, realistically, are also likely to have long-term trade-offs. Okay, well, I'd like to end the regular reporting with some good news on one of the best ways to prevent disease and death in your life, which is diet. And here's a couple stories from nutritionfacts.org. The optimal diet is put to the test. The CHIP program, now called PIVIO, has attempted to take the pioneering lifestyle medicine work of Pritikin and Ornish and spread it out into the community. England has been keeping mortality statistics since 1665, when one person was, quote, killed by a fall downstairs at St. Thomas Apostle. That same week, though, nearly 4,000 people died of the plague. Well, today, the modern plague is heart disease, the number one killer of men and women, but it wasn't always this way. If you dig into those old statistics, heart disease was already killing off 5 to 10% of the population by the middle of the last century. But it was practically unknown at the beginning of the 20th century. Consider the natural history of coronary heart disease in the 1920s and 1930s. It skyrocketed tenfold in both men and women. What was going on? We get a clue in a study that divided people by socioeconomic class. The richest folks had up to triple the heart disease of the poorest. Did it have something to do with their rich diets? You don't know until you put it to the test. In doing so, we discover the natural cure of coronary heart disease found decades ago by Nathan Pritikin, who developed the eponymous plant-based diet and lifestyle program, followed by Dean Ornish and then Caldwell Esselstyn at the Cleveland Clinic. But how many know of the name Hans Diehl? Dr. Diehl was the first director of research at the Pritikin Center back in 1976. He was inspired by the amazing results they were getting. Diehl recognized the limitations of live-in residential programs, including their costs and the artificial living environment that made sustaining the learned behaviors more difficult for participants when they returned to their home setting. In response, Diehl developed CHIP, now known as the Complete Health Improvement Program, as an affordable 30-day lifestyle intervention to be delivered to individuals in their community. 10 years in, Dr. Esselstyn encouraged Dr. Diehl to publish the results in the American Journal of Cardiology, Coronary Risk Reduction Through Intensive Community-Based Lifestyle Intervention, the Coronary Health Improvement Project, CHIP Experience. Famously started with a quote from the pioneer of coronary bypass surgery, who described it as, quote, only a palliative treatment. The incidence of coronary disease will only be decreased by proper preventive measures. We know that vigorous cholesterol lowering can slow, arrest, or even reverse atherosclerosis, but it only works if you do it. Live-in programs work because you can control people's diets, but they're expensive and people may go back home to toxic food environments. So instead of them coming to you, what if you go to them in the community? The original program was 16 evening sessions over 4 weeks. The major focus of the program was to encourage participants to adopt the optimal diet, and they were also encouraged to exercise 30 minutes a day. Most importantly, however, they were to embrace centering their diet around whole plant foods. Now that was the optimal, a whole food plant-based diet. But the program did not prescribe a dietary dogma, but instead encouraged participants to move along the spectrum toward the ad libitum consumption of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes, incorporating more whole, healthy plant foods into their diets. They didn't provide meals, just advice and encouragement. And after only 4 weeks, there was an average weight loss of about 6 pounds. Blood pressures went down about 6 points. Bad LDL cholesterol went down 16 to 32 points. And fasting blood sugars dropped as well. Often, participants were able to decrease or discontinue cholesterol-lowering or blood pressure-lowering medication, making their findings even more extraordinary. Indeed, they achieved better numbers on fewer drugs. Live-in programs such as the Pritikin Longevity Center and the McDougall program are great in that you can optimize the clinical benefits, but they can cost thousands of dollars and cause many participants to miss work. On the other hand, CHIP is cheap, and people can live at home, so they aren't spoon-fed a perfect diet for a few weeks at some spa, only to go back to their cupboards of cookies. CHIP is a free living program teaching people how to eat and stay healthy within their home environments. At least that's a theory. These remarkable results were after just 4 weeks in the program. The true test, however, will be to what extent people adhere to their new lifestyle and sustain their health benefits. Which brings us to the next blog entry from nutritionfacts.org. Which diet works even better the longer you do it? The most well-published community-based lifestyle intervention in the medical literature is also one of the most effective. CHIP, the Complete Health Improvement Program, also known as PIVIO, may be the most well-published community-based lifestyle intervention in the medical literature. It is also one of the most effective, with clinical changes approaching those outcomes achieved in live-in residential lifestyle programs. CHIP encourages people to transition towards a more whole food, plant-based diet, and the average reductions in blood pressure were greater than those reported in the DASH, the Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension study, and comparable with the results of blood pressure-lowering drug trials. If we're going to reverse the worldwide chronic disease epidemic, though, we've got to scale this up. To make CHIP more accessible to a wider audience, each of Hans Steele's live presentations were videotaped. Then a trained and certified volunteer facilitator got people in a room to watch the videos and helped foster discussion. When it comes to safe, simple, side-effect-free solutions, such as a healthier diet and lifestyle, you don't need to wait for a doctor to show up and give a lecture. Sounds great, but does it work? Those individuals who were the worst of the worst and participated in the program, finishing all the videos, had a 20-point drop in blood pressure, a 40-point drop in bad LDL cholesterol, and more than a 500-point drop in triglycerides. Of those who came in with diabetic-level fasting blood sugars, about 1 in 3 left with non-diabetic-level fasting blood sugars. Remember, all this was achieved simply by empowering people with knowledge. Just encouraging people to move towards a whole food, plant-based diet led to these remarkable benefits. What was the effectiveness of this volunteer-delivered lifestyle modification program on 5,000 participants? The same kind of significant reductions in weight, blood pressure, cholesterol, triglycerides, and blood sugars were found. Most studies giving dietary advice to free-living subjects can be expected to reduce blood total cholesterol by only 3 to 6%, but a sustained reduction in blood total cholesterol concentration of 1% is associated with a 2 to 3% reduction in the incidence of heart disease. So, on a population scale, even small differences matter. Put thousands of people through just 1 month of CHIP, however, and you get an 11% drop on average and up to a nearly 20% drop among those who need it most. Do the participants maintain their healthy habits, though? Doctors can't even get most people to take a single pill once a day. How effective can volunteer-led video series be at getting people to maintain a change of eating habits. Researchers looked at the CHIP data to find out. How were participants doing 18 months after completing the program? Most were able to maintain their reductions of meat, dairy, and eggs, though some of the junk food had started to slip back in. Their fruit and veggie consumption dipped, though not back to baseline. Ready for the huge shocker? Even though the participants had been told explicitly to eat as much as they wanted without any calorie or carb counting and without any portion control, just by being informed about the benefits of centering their diets more on whole plant foods, by the end of the 6-week program, they were eating, on average, about 339 fewer calories a day without even trying. Instead of trying to eat less food, they were just eating healthier food and happened to eat less food. But that was right at the end of the 6-week program, and they were all jazzed up. Where were they 18 months later? Anyone familiar with weight loss studies knows exactly how it works. You can excite anybody in the short term to lose weight using practically any kind of diet. But then after 6 months or a year, they tend to gain it all back, or even more. The CHIP participants were eating about 300 fewer calories a day during the program. But 18 months later, they were eating about 400 fewer calories. What kind of diet can work even better the longer you do it? A whole food, plant-based diet. Many weight loss programs restrict energy or calorie intake by limiting portion sizes, which often results in hunger and dissatisfaction with the eating regime, thus contributing to low compliance and weight regain. But the satiety-promoting, all-you-care-to-eat plant-based whole food dietary approach may be the secret weapon of sustainable weight loss. Okay, folks, well, that does it for the regular reporting. Now on to the bonus article section of the show, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. Well, folks, a record short list of bonus articles, only 4 this week. But it's quality, not quantity. Up first, number 1. Transitioning to net zero emissions could be the greatest health opportunity of this century. So definitely climate change is a public health issue and an opportunity for improving and maintaining public health. Article 2. Twitter has spent years trying to combat health misinformation. Will Musk takeover make that harder? Short answer, yes. And 3. Thinking through the holidays this year, that means regarding COVID. So this is my epidemiologist, one of my favorite blogs, actually goes through with her family about what their plans are. And it's a good template for actually understanding what you and your family might be able to do in order to minimize COVID exposure and protect those that are most vulnerable. And lastly, 4, I want to put a plug in for nutritionfacts.org, which was the source of those last 2 articles that I did in the regular portion of the episode. This is a nonprofit organization that's basically run by a prevention medicine doc, and has found that the convergence of the latest scientific information and nutrition really converges around a whole food plant-based diet, which overlaps a lot with veganism, but is just from the nutritional perspective. It isn't necessarily about animal rights or anything like that, although that dovetails just wonderfully into it. But nutritionfacts.org is the place I go for the latest and best scientific information on nutrition, and it's presented through short videos and topical blogs, so it's easy to access. You can sign up for updates. They even have I think it's a 30-day set of emails that you can get that'll kind of run you through like a little mini course on nutrition. A lot of cool resources, so I would strongly recommend it. Nutritionfacts.org, so you can become the most informed nutrition within your social network. So you can access these and all the shows that I've covered during this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And what do you know? This has been the shortest episode that I've recorded in literally years. But again, it's about quality, not quantity. I'll be right back at you next week with likely a full hour show. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.